Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 The Fan present Point Taken, a podcast connecting you to the sports and pop culture issues you care about and the guests you want to hear more from. Now, here's Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 2 of Point Taken. We have yet to be canceled. We are still on the air, the internet, or however this works. A fun episode coming up.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a week of trials and tribulations physically for both of us, as I found out. I thought I was the only one holding back my my injury. I was like an athlete disguising my injury issues because my left knee was about double the size that it should be when we taped everything last week for week
one. Oh, really?
I was hiding. I was playing through pain. I was playing hurt. You do this in April and May.
Mine was double its size this weekend. We were playing in this, a bunch of us from work were playing in this charity softball tournament. It was the Roberto Alomar Celebrity Slow Pitch Tournament for charity in Brampton. And I got a little too into it.
And
I
so
was
how,
in the outfield.
How was the team selected?
Whoever wanted to play. Ken Reed was in charge.
I've seen pictures.
Central.
He was in charge?
Well,
you let him craft the roster?
Yeah. Hey, we finished 2-1. We didn't make the playoffs. We got our butts kicked in that final game.
Yeah, you mentioned, I can't remember if you put it on Twitter, you mentioned on email, it was something to do with run differential. Did you know the rules? Like, you should have run up the score in one of your two wins, and you didn't do that. You're being gentlemanly and ladylike.
You know what?
Much.
It was actually Lloyd Mosby was the captain of our team, and he was the third base coach, and he was the one being a gentleman because he was making sure we didn't run right through third and go home too often.
You weren't taking extra bases on. Well, nobody wants an inside pitch in slow pitch, but you're not going to get beaned in slow pitch. There's only so much the other team can do once you start running up the score.
Yeah.
They can't throw high and inside in slow pitch. They can throw high.
We're just trying to make contact. We're not even. I mean, the team we lost to, they were able to really pick their spots, and we look like a bunch of amateurs, and then I was reminded that we are a bunch of amateurs.
Now, was this a sport? Were you a baseball, softball player? Like you're
oh, yeah.
You're okay.
I used to play. You probably wouldn't have been able to tell it on Saturday. So I think, you know, when you used to play and you're competitive and you're in the game and you get in the mindset and there's a ball coming towards me in left field and I'm hustling, running forward, trying to get it. And I think, you know what? I'm going to make it. Even though logic says, no, Carolyn, you're not going to make it. So I slid to try and make the catch, but instead of going in my glove, the ball just hit me in the knee.
Kevin Pillar does that 3 times a game and sometimes doesn't.
That's true.
He gets accused of diving for balls that he doesn't need to dive for.
But
that wasn't the case in your case.
Right. Well, yeah. And let's just remember everything's happening a little bit slower in softball. Anyway, so I have a bruise of the laces of the ball on my knee to show it. It's like a new tattoo.
But you would have been, I saw the picture. I'm guessing, I feel like you were one of the younger, like as far as the roster construction, because Ken Reed is in my neighborhood of being almost, like half our lives are over. Like someone younger than me called me a middle-aged man a year ago, and I thought about it. I'm like, yeah, if I get double the years I've got now, I'm happy with that.
I'd
sign up for that.
So I should.
You don't want to be middle-aged
next...
right now, then you'd be dead too early.
Oh man!
You want to be one third through your life, maybe a quarter.
Yeah,
even.
But just because I was sore the next day doesn't mean I'm weak.
No. But it means but bones get more brittle as they like I can't bend down. If I drop something in the grocery store, there's a process to the bending. Whereas for the first 30 years of my life, it was an automatic reach down and grab.
Have you fallen and not you weren't able to get up?
Well,
in the grocery
I played
store?
My. I've had two scopes on my knee. I had my first. On my left knee when I was 31, and all of a sudden I thought it was the start of shin splints, but it was way more serious, and there was loose cartilage and an ACL meniscus problems and a lot of bone on bone crunching. And if you ever had your knee drained, I can't even describe to you.
That's a picture.
But the two scopes I've had have been the only two times I've been put under via anesthetic, and I will say I'd sign up. That's fun.
Oh,
it's fun going out.
I had that once.
Because I'm not a drug person, and I really wasn't at any point in time. A lot of ex-radio people or a lot of radio people say that they are. Maybe I think it's generational. the two times I went under, I'm like, you get about 10 seconds where you're like, this is a pretty cool ride. And then you wake up and again. Now, so I played two hockey games in the Baycrest, and my knee... There were two major problems. One was, of course, my shower etiquette, which was discussed mostly off the air podcast.
Oh, I've heard about this.
Yeah, I know you have. See, no one's going to go into it. No one wants to pry into your shower etiquette. You guys,
no, that's true.
You play a game, and then you guess what? Everybody's a little odorous. Then you play another game, no one gets hurt.
Here's the backstory: is apparently, from what I've heard, and this is just he said.
A lot of him saying it, yeah.
That you did not shower after the tournament, and then you all went out for drinks.
Well, that's not all. We went out for one drink for a brief window of about 48, 50 minutes. And
in a small contained space.
That's right.
Where smell spreads.
But then I played the second game, and I thought, the hell with this. I'm going home to shower properly and maybe even sit in the tub because I knew my knee was flaring up. And so why have a shower and get right in your car and go? And then, you let your car air out the next day. But I'm carrying children in my car who change their socks every 5 days.
Ugh.
Thank you. Exactly.
See, softball tournament, you couldn't shower right after.
There's nowhere to go.
And it poured rain, and I was covered in dirt. I had to stop for gas, and people were looking at me. I looked like I'd been through war.
Right. So have you ever played 18 holes of golf in 30-degree weather, and you're all sitting around afterwards, and none of you are like, you commiserate together. You're not like, we should all get away from each other right now, because one or four of us might not smell like we did 5 hours ago. Nobody says that. But as it was explained to you, and you'd concur in this, there's this guy hockey thing where you sit around and you're talking and you're in various states of undress, and that's apparently a bonding experience. I don't need that at this point in my life. But you acknowledge it exists, and I don't understand it either. I'm just not part of I'm not part of that club anymore.
Yeah, everyone was freaking out. This has been talked about now for what, a week and a half? I went on Andrew Walker show with Walker and JD, and they brought it up about you not showering.
But again, no one is asking if Ken Reed showered. No one wants to know. No one's prying into your shower habits on a daily basis.
Well, I feel like that.
I've never noticed any problem.
If they ask people about showering.
I suppose. Yeah, I suppose.
It's probably a violation of something.
So was there any? Did you play against any team? Any combatant? Before we get to Bob Bugner, did you play against anybody that you thought, you know what? We're here for charity. You're hook sliding. You're taking it to. You're using a donut in the on deck circle. You have too many batting gloves. Any of that happening?
Yes. And so I take it very seriously because I'm competitive, but I take it seriously just with myself. I'm not going to get mad at other people or opponents. There was one team who shall remain
nameless. Why don't you name
nameless.
Them? Because people want names.
But it's a charity event.
But you don't have to mention the person.
Well, I know, but you mention the company and then you kind of know. And anyway,
we'll organize a boycott of the company. They'll go under. It'll all be your fault. Their shares will drop.
All I'll say is Carly Agro, I thought, was going to get in a fight. Because she was basically knocked over at third base.
Oh, so it's not that she's more competitive than you. She was actually hit on a sliding incident.
Yeah.
Of
a blocking incident.
A blocking incident, a play
that is my biggest pet peeve, though. At the any type of now, I mean, we're adult. We are not competitive like we used to be. Just take it easy. Even university intramurals, people took it a little bit too seriously.
You do co-ed softball. There are two things about co-ed softball I remember from Western. One is I thought it was sexist I thought it demeaned the process of the game. If you walked a female player, she didn't get to go to first base. She got to go to second base.
What?
Now, do you find that somewhat demeaning?
Yes.
You're like, hello, I can run the bait. Thank you.
Yes. That was actually my favorite part, too, of co-ed intramurals, is they always had to have two girls on the field at all times. And then people just automatically assumed you were bad because of that.
So you feel people were trying to exploit your girldom and hit the ball, like big strapping guys were trying to hit the ball to you, I suppose.
Yeah, a little bit. But then it was even better when you could just show them up.
You can show them up.
But, I mean, that's a ridiculous rule that you get to walk second.
Well, I thought so.
I guess you can just take advantage, but that's dumb.
But I probably didn't. My altruism probably ended. My chivalrous nature ended there when you'd see a pop fly coming towards like a female at second base. And at least in her case, I don't want to name names either, but I can remember a couple people. You know she's not going to catch the ball, so you sort of camp beside her.
Right.
And it falls, like you're hoping it bounces off her glove and into yours. You're waiting for a deflection play, like a tip play. And you shouldn't do that. Apparently that's bad etiquette just to stand there, brace yourself, because then she blames you. She's like, I heard your footsteps, and you scared me. And so naturally, I'm not going to catch the ball. I'm like,
yeah, but
you
weren't
catching that anyway.
I do that. It doesn't matter, man or woman. I do that behind people.
You see no sex during softball. You're not non-judgmental, apparently.
No,
about
but
it.
If someone's bad, regardless who they are. You should back them up just to make sure.
But backing up isn't standing beside them, stressing them out, and they know you're going to yell at them. You're going to throw your glove on the ground and spike it when they drop the ball. Now, I do think a good rule is in intramural broom ball, which I
is that a thing?
I led a team to a championship. It's my one university championship. I'm very
proud.
Did you
get a purple shirt? We both went to Western, and when I was at Western, you got a purple shirt.
I think we did, but
it's
I kept
Stanley Cup.
I insisted on keeping the ball, and I had everybody sign the ball, and I still have it at my parents'.
Which is probably Western University property.
Yeah, they all for all the tuition, all the missed intercession courses, it really all the rent paid. But a female in broom ball, if she scored a goal, it was worth two. Now I like that because then it encouraged aggressive forward play. So if you got a female goal in a game, it was worth double the goal of a male. Now you're staring at me like that's also bad. But in 1994, we didn't think so.
No,
we thought that was good. I thought that encouraged because then guys aren't hogging the ball up. And if you get down two goals, you need one play.
We had that in football. So I would often play quarterback because any play where a girl was involved, you got more points.
Good for you.
So I thought, okay, well, this is slightly offensive, but
is it even slightly?
Okay, it's offensive. But I thought, hey, if you guys are the idiots who want to make this rule, let's just kick your butts. Let's take advantage.
Like if we
play
tennis against each other, you're younger, so I would say any ball I hit, I get the doubles alley. Now that's not there's no such thing as reverse sexism or reverse racism. It's either sex. Yes,
ageist.
Thank you. I think when Jimmy Connors played Martina Navratilova once in a charity match, he got to hit the ball into the she got to hit the ball into the doubles alley.
Oh no.
But do you want a fair
match
or not? It's not exactly Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King, but it's which I wasn't even alive for.
That's not good.
Isn't there there is a movie, by the way. We'll talk TV later on in the podcast after we have a couple great guests, but I feel like there's a Billie Jean King Bobby Riggs movie coming out.
Really?
I think so, but I'm not sure who's in it. By the time we end the podcast, we will know, and we will let you know.
Better Google this.
We'll Google it. So thank you for, by the way, just a quick thanks for all the response from people. You can follow on Twitter at SNPointTaken, and we'll try and post. We've only got like three posts up there. Hi, there's a podcast. Hi, we're recording it. Hi, here it is. But I don't know what else to say. It has 1,000-something followers already after 1 week, so we're happy about that.
I think it's the new Twitter picture. We finally have a Twitter picture. You put that on, I assume?
Yeah, I didn't get, usually you and I have been, we've been very democratic about decisions, and we should be, because we're really equal investors in this. But
I was livid. I look and I thought I was not consolidated.
I saw the standard Twitter egg thing, and I thought people like anytime an egg writes me, I'm like this may not end well, and so I thought we put up a picture of two microphones, but we're still yet to do a picture together, which we could do actually today for next week's podcast.
That's true.
So we'll do that later. We'll talk to Mike Edgar later in the show. He's an Irish music presenter and disc jockey. And he's a lot of thoughts on U2. He knew U2 when they were teenagers. So he's going to run us through some of the early stories, some of the ups and downs. They've been mostly ups because they just played in Vancouver. You had friends go to the show.
Yeah, it looked really nice. I mean, if in this day and age, if you go to a concert and don't post about it on social media, were you really there?
Before you bought a t-shirt, and that cost you $30, and here there's a little bit of data usage recording, like, I will follow, or I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
I feel like I was at
the concert. It's almost as much money.
I was basically at the concert.
I feel like that's gone out now. I don't know if people go to high school and they wear a concert t-shirt, and people are like, oh, were you at the concert last ask me about this. Ask me about my Instagram account where I took a picture of every single thing I did for every moment in the entire – like Eric Smith's on one of these tears right now where he's posting a picture every
day. Picture a day. That is a commitment.
Yes, but at what cost? I don't mean to his credibility. I mean to his free time.
We need to have him on to discuss it.
Let's wait and see if he gets to day 300.
Okay.
Let's wait till November or so when he's just lagging for ideas of, like, here's a plastic bag, and it's day 299. Everybody have a great day. So we'll talk Memorial Cup. It's exciting for Sportsnet because Sportsnet has the entire Memorial Cup. Our friend Jeff Merrick is en route to Windsor soon.
Yeah.
Down the 401. They have a reasonably new arena. They've got an odd situation because the Windsor Spitfires have sat and waited for about 7 weeks because they lost to the London Knights in the first round of the OHL playoffs. And it's not like summer break. You have to sit and still be prepared and play high-intensity hockey against all these other teams, including St. John, including Erie, I was in the Memorial Cup again. It's funny. The one year they have Connor McDavid, they didn't make it, and Oshawa made it and won the Memorial Cup. But Erie's been very good the 2 years since Connor McDavid left. So we're going to talk to Bob Bugner. He is the majority owner of the Windsor Spitfires. He has coached in the Memorial Cup two different times and won the Memorial Cup both times, once in really impressive fashion in which they were down two games to none, basically. They started the round robin 0-2. They won the next four games and won, and then they went unbeaten the entire next year, right the year before Taylor Hall was drafted by the Edmonton Oilers. And Bob Bugner joins us now on Sportsnet Point Taken. You know, Windsor kid, you've owned the team for over a decade now, and you've done your share of winning behind the bench with them. This will be a bit of a different feel given how your NHL concentration is, but still probably a dream come true for you to be the majority owner of a team hosting the Memorial Cup in a league you played in.
It is amazing. I mean, you know, I had a season ticket holder event last night. We had about 500 people show up, and I told them the exact same thing. Is, you know, this week coming up here in the Memorial Cup has been 10 years in the making for us. When we bought the team in 2006, you know, one of the things we said is that we wanted to bring a Memorial Cup to our city. And, you know, it's not for us. It's not for, you know, necessarily the Windsor Spitfires. It's great to be in it, in the tournament, but it's more for the city. And it's a lot of excitement around here right now. I mean, I got a coffee here and walked the rink at 8 o'clock this morning and looking at all the crews just building out and changing signs and, you know, the Molson Hockey House getting built up and all the other stuff that's going on here. It's a pretty cool experience, and we haven't even started yet.
Was it hard getting ready for the Memorial Cup throughout the season, even watching the Spitfires when you were busy in San Jose?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I watch as many games as I can, and you know, well, my assistant coaches, Pete DeVore and Steve Spott, are all alumni of the OHL, so there's not too many nights that goes by we don't have an OHL game up in our office before our games with the time change, so we get to see everything. So we have some laughs about that, but you know, I stayed in touch with the coaches and obviously the business side of things, and we had a great staff back here, and they worked hard. It started last summer before I left for San Jose. Really, I think we have 20 different committees. We have 500 volunteers. There's a lot of moving parts, but there's a lot of people in the city that have helped out and been great to us.
We'll come back to the Memorial Cup. Let's get the Sharks stuff out of the way. It's so hard to win in this league. You know that. You've played for several different teams and 65 playoff games, 630 in the regular season, part of a couple great runs in Buffalo and Pittsburgh, and you go all the way to Game 6 last year, and sometimes when we were kids, it just felt like, yeah, the best teams always won, and we were used to dynasties, and now you need to get bounces, you need a timely save. These are coin flip series now, especially in your conference.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, from our experience last year, we found that out that, you know, we were a 500 team at Christmas last season, and then we ended up just getting on a run and getting hot going into the playoffs, and we rode that to the finals. You know, same thing this year. We're one of the best teams in the league all year. Difference being in March, we played 18 games in 36 days, and we hit a wall. And, you know, I think it's from the year before. I think it's from the World Cup. We had seven guys at the World Cup, and they left in August. So some of our guys only had a couple weeks off all year. And we're a bit of an older team. I think we hit the wall. And you could see now the final four teams here. I mean, you know, see there's some injuries and there's some fatigue setting in. And, you know, they're one goal games. There's a bounce here there, like you said. And, It is amazing the parity in the league and how tough it is to get through this your conference, let alone winning the Stanley Cup. So, you know, you got to give Pittsburgh a lot of credit going as far as they did last year and being back in the Final Four. And it's going to be interesting. It's been a lot of fun watching, that's for sure.
When you're behind the bench, do you feel headed into the playoffs when you're hitting a wall? Do you feel like that might carry through to the playoffs? Or does it feel like a fresh start when you begin the postseason?
Yeah, you know, it's a fresh start. I think, you know, to be honest with you, a lot of guys are just trying to get through the last 8-10 games and stay healthy. Now, there's teams, that was our case. There's teams that obviously are pushing the last 10 games because they need every point to get in. But in our case in San Jose, it was more of a, you know, we're in, we know we're in. You know, we're trying to stay healthy. We're trying to get through it. And, you know, I think that can hurt you a little bit as well. Sometimes the teams that are getting in, like Nashville's a wild card spot. They had to play playoff hockey for the last month, and you could see you could see how good they're playing right now and how desperate they had to be just to make the playoffs. So pretty amazing the different mental states coming in. And, you know, Chicago was another team that they knew they were in probably with a month and a half to go. And, you know, maybe that's a bad thing sometimes. I think some of these teams that got to fight, it's an advantage.
Bob Bugner is our guest. He's the San Jose Sharks assistant coach and majority owner of the Windsor Spitfires. coached the Spits to two Memorial Cup titles, and they host the Memorial Cup starting this Friday in Windsor. Let me ask you about being on that Penguins team, and I want to ask you about two players. Obviously, that's the year Mario came back, so you're on that team. You start to hear buzz about it, and I feel like his first game was against Toronto, and he had 4 or 5 points in it. And obviously, you know, Jágr's 28, and you still have to game plan against him twice a year, and he's 45. Tell me about that season with Mario coming back, and you probably did get to play with Jaromír Jágr basically at the peak of his prime, really.
Yeah, and both players are obviously amazing and different. I'll never forget that. It's one of my biggest hockey memories, I think, from the NHL is that night and watching Mario come back. I don't. There wasn't too many dry eyes in the building. It was 3 years, I believe. And, you know, being a player and seeing Mario on the plane and with a suit on and, you know, coming around the dressing room was pretty amazing in itself. And then when he announced his comeback, all of a sudden he's got his equipment on. And at that point in time that year, I had a broken wrist and I was rehabbing. So me and him rehabbed basically together every day and skated every day and conditioned every day together and hung out quite a bit. And it was amazing to see him from that side of things. And Jágr's the same way. He's an amazing player, completely different. But, you know, you got to respect the longevity and his love for the game. Unreal playmaker and went in his prime and just so heavy on the puck. It was we had a great team there. We had some great players, the Kovalevs, the Strakas, the Bobby Langs, and the list goes on and on. We had some great players there, and it was, you know, it was a shame we didn't win it with that kind of a team.
Well, Jágr needs a new head coach next year in Florida. You've made it very clear that you do want to have a head coaching position one day down the line in the NHL. Do you think you could maybe fit in Florida with young players like Aaron Ekblad? You're both from Belle River, Ontario. Do you think you'd fit in with that young team?
I do. I mean, I've made no secret about, you know, my vision and where I want to get to and why I'm doing what I'm doing here and moving away from home and the family and the whole bit. And I really like the Florida team, to be honest with you. And I've known Ekblad my whole life. You know, I see him all the time during the summer. He's actually buddies with my son. So I see him around the house a lot, and you know, I've got some familiarity with that team. I've had Derek McKenzie in Columbus. I had Reimer in San Jose. I've had Pisek and Petrovic at the under-18s. Ivan Hlinka. So pretty familiar with the team, and I think they have a great base moving forward. You know, whether I get the interview, there's been some talk, and you know, everybody's gone right now for the World Championships. But I think when the general managers all get back in town, I think I have a good chance of getting down there and sitting in front of them. So I'd be looking forward to that. But again, they're so tough, 30 jobs in the whole world. And I mean, it's a great competition out there, great candidates, and then they're awfully tough to get. So right time, right place, and cross the fingers, you know?
So let's go back to when you bought the team. You buy it with Warren Reichel, who you knew really well, who was scouting at the time for the Coyotes. You buy it with Peter Dobrich, but you're playing in Colorado, and I mean, sure, a lot of players, current and ex, sit around and they talk about, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we did this? Normal people do this. Wouldn't it be great to own a minor league baseball team or a baseball team or a hockey team? When did the serious conversations amongst you and sort of your inner circle happen that you could do this? And were you juggling the end of your playing career at the same time?
Yeah, it's funny. The story, you know, it was in 2004, and everybody knows we had a lockout, and I was the vice president of the NHLPA at the time. So I spent a lot of time in Toronto and in New York and Chicago at the NHL offices and at the NHLPA offices and did a ton of negotiating. And that was basically my job. But I was living in Windsor at the time, full time, my hometown. And the odd night I wasn't in a CBA negotiation or in a law office somewhere, I would come to the Spits games, and Warren and I would go, and he was scouting for Phoenix at the time. So we'd sit up there and, you know, we'd talk about how great it would be. Two Windsor guys own the team, this and that. And at the time, they were going through some turmoil. And, you know, we just, you know, we just reached out to the owner at the time. And you know, eventually a deal was there at the end of the day. But, you know, it took us almost a year to negotiate and actually get the deal. And but, you know, since then, there's been no looking back. It's been a great thing to own. I mean, we got the new rink here. Everybody remembers the old barn, but the new rink's been amazing for our organization. And, you know, obviously winning two Memorial Cups and some of the guys that have come through the doors here that developed underneath of us and that are now, you know, superstars in the NHL. From, you know, watch Ryan Ellis every night. you know, I still remember going to his house. He's 15 years old, just outside of Burlington area, and, you know, seeing the puck marks on his garage and the little guy coming out and, you know, sort of recruiting him and bringing him in, and now look at him. So those are kind of great memories that I think about, is the guys that came through our doors and won championships and now make careers for themselves.
Now, the best part is, too, I mean, the first year, I start working for you guys the second year, so I got to know you guys and watch. But when I'm doing the games in Saginaw the year before, you're an 18-win team, but everybody could see you guys are doing it the right way. How much patience did you have that first year? Because everybody wants things right away. So you're behind the bench and you're like, you know, I know I can coach, but we got to get through the hard times here and draft the Adam Henriques and let them develop and draft Taylor Hall and draft these players. That first season couldn't have been easy. And yet, like I said, there was a buzz. Everyone knew you guys were good for the league and everyone knew you guys were going to do it the right way.
Yeah, you know, it was tough in the beginning, and we knew that we had a good draft. We just didn't know how good, and we said, you know, we're going to play all the young guys. And I think at the time we played 5 16-year-olds that year. The rules were different than they are now. I believe after the deadline, you were allowed to call another guy up, which was Wellwood at the time playing junior B. So I think we had at one point in time we had 6 or 7 16-year-olds playing in our lineup, and we took a lot of abuse that season, you know, just because we were playing in the West in a good division, and we lost a lot of hockey games, but our kids really developed because of the ice time and because of the roles they got put into. And, you know, you double that up with another good draft and all of a sudden, you know, things turn the corner. And, you know, from a coaching standpoint, what I did is just with no experience, I had some amazing coaches in the NHL that, you know, I sort of tried to get all their things I liked about them and you know, things I didn't really like and sort of develop my own philosophy. And I'm talking about the Joel Quenvilles and the Barry Trotz and the Daryl Sutters of the world, guys like that I had as coaches. And we knew how we wanted to treat these kids and make this place a culture. We wanted to create and we wanted to make this a place people wanted to come and play for us and they wanted to play for the Windsor Spitfires. And slowly we changed the culture and we developed and that's what happened. We ended up winning a couple championships and we made a few trades here and there, but for the most part it was developed through the draft.
Well, you mentioned that right now your family's in Ontario, so you must spend a lot of time with Pete DeBoer and Steve Spott. People know Steve Spott maybe from his time in Kitchener and also coaching with the Marlies. Is it true? Do you guys all live together, or what's the living situation like? Is this like a modern-day frat house?
Yeah, that's what we call it. It's the frat house, yeah. I actually was the only one. We also have Johan Hedberg, the goalie coach there, too, but I have my own place, and I broke at the end of the year, and my lease was up, so we all lived together for the last few months of the hockey season, and I had a lot of fun, and you know what? It is nice when your families aren't there. We're all in the same boat. Yeah, so we have the frat house, the San Jose frat house, we call it, and we had some good laughs and some good fun.
Tell us about the economics of what you realized early on. And like it probably was night and day, because I was with you guys one of your last years in the barn, and you knew it'd have a bigger economic impact for the community and for ownership and to be able to provide facilities just alone for players when you got to the new place. What was the one thing that jumped out in you, not in terms of raw numbers, but I can't believe this cost this much, or I can't believe we're saving money on this, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, first and foremost was the lease that we had to negotiate, which is a good lease, but we, you know, obviously wanted into a new place and just the economics of it, you know. But with that comes bigger revenues and more seats and the whole bit. So that was an eye-opener from that standpoint. But you're right, and you touched on it. It's, for us, the biggest advantage was obviously attracting a bigger fan base and being able to recruit players. It was tough at the barn, and, you know, the facilities weren't there, and you want to make it safe. Of the art, you want to make it a place players want to come, and that's the biggest thing that turned for us with the new building, and it's just making us putting sort of the cherry on top of a great organization. The hockey part was there, the development part was there, then we finally got the arena.
Tell me also about the way the league's changed. It feels, I always say on the radio, it feels a little more like American college football, and you know what that's like. That's what recruiting is now. When you went to the Sioux in 1988, there weren't many power plays guys could pull. Lindros was really the first big name that said, listen, I'm not sure I can go this route. And now you know what it's like with agents and parents and a lot of the head games, and guys say, well, no, I'm going to go to the NCAA, and all of a sudden everybody skips them, and he ends up 5 minutes from home. These things are they happen more now than they used to, but it's how they have to play the game, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think players have so many more options than they did before. The league's bigger, better, and You know, and I'll tell you the one thing that I noticed over the years is that the coaching is so good now. There's always good coaches, but I mean, there's 20 teams that they really dig in and they really get some good coaching and some good general managers, and everybody is looking for that little advantage. And you know, the agents are trying to take care of their clients and their families. And but you know, the one thing I would say, the biggest difference is you know, we've done a good job, I think, as owners and as a league, really supplying these guys with amazing scholarship packages. Now that back in the day they had, it's either you're going to the NCAA to get your schooling or you're going to the OHL to play hockey. Well, that's not like that anymore. I mean, every kid gets a scholarship, every kid gets taken care of. And so it's made our league a little more competitive, and you don't hear so many of those head games between NCAA or OHL. And I'm proud of that as a franchise owner, and the rest of our partners in the league. They've done a real good job at stepping up on these things.
Bob Bugner's our guest on the Point Taken podcast. A couple more minutes with him. This tournament is real short. These aren't best of seven series that have a lot of ebbs and flows to it. And you know that more than anybody. In 2009, you go to Rimouski, and within like less than 24 hours, because you got to play a day game on the weekend, you lose 3-2 in overtime to Drummondville. You lose 5-4 to Rimouski. How is the feeling? Not that the tournament's over. It's rough for the players. How much coaching outside outside the bench did you really have to do in the next off day to get your guys? And for folks who don't know, you win a game, then you win the tiebreaker, then you win the semifinal in overtime, and then your easiest win seemed to be the final against Kelowna, and you do the impossible. You come back from 0-2 down and win the Memorial Cup.
Yeah, those were times that, you know, I've actually was talking to the staff about that today, to Rocky Thompson and his staff of, you know, they're prepping the guys for Friday night and against St. John. And, you know, I just warned them. I thought at one point in time there in Rimouski, our first cup, that we had such an amazing team. I think we only lost 8 games all year or something like that. And I thought that we probably overprepared the guys and we tried to, you know, break down our opponents and worry about who's who and line combinations, who to worry about, what they're doing on their forecheck. And what we said after being down 0-2 is just, listen, you know what, it's about us, let's do our thing, let make people worry about us. And you know, I sort of stressed that to the coaches this morning. Obviously they're prepping for each team, but you're right, when you're down 0-2, your life's on the line. We had such a good season, we didn't want to ruin that. And what we did was, instead of going to a rink and practicing and worrying about X and O's, we actually took the guys to a pool house, and we sat down and we had a pool tournament. And the guys just sat back and just relaxed. And we didn't want them to make them think about hockey. And, you know, sometimes that reverse psychology works. So I just think that we over-prepared and we didn't worry about ourselves enough. And then I think we learned our lessons in the second cup and we just went there and played our game. So you're right. And that's the one thing about the Windsor Spitfires. We didn't, you know, we had some disappointment, got knocked out by a good team in the first round, game 7. But you're right, this isn't a 7-game series. We know we have a good team. We're healthy. We got in our hometown and our home rinks, so I'm looking forward to see how they're going to react to that.
So how are you going to be watching this Memorial Cup? In your position, you kind of sit on your hands and bite your tongue, or just speak up when you see something on the ice?
Yeah, you know what? I think if they ask, I'll help. I mean, we have a capable staff. But what we did last week was, my little part is I brought in some guys to talk to the team. And one was DJ Smith, the assistant coach for the Toronto Maple Leafs, an ex-coach here, a good friend of mine. Brought him in and we talked about, you know, the chance these guys have, the legacy, about how it was when we won. And, you know, and then I brought in, I spoke myself, then I brought in Steve Ott from a different point of view of a player, and then Mike Weber. And believe it or not, the best guy that talked to anybody was Harry Young, our captain, who's now a Windsor policeman. And he walked in and, you know, he talked about how special it was to win. And, you know, he still sees his name on banners and bus stops around town as a captain of a 2-time World Cup champion. So, I mean, it was really cool. The kids really thought that was amazing to hear. And, you know, so I'm trying to, like, be around, but not too much. And just if anybody needs to ask anything, that kind of thing, and I'm going to be in the background and try and enjoy it as much as I can.
I tell you what, there are players I rode the bus with I wouldn't want being a cop. Harry Young's a perfect cop. I'm actually frightened that you, like, I get nervous when they're in my rearview mirror now. The idea that it's Harry Young driving down Olette Avenue would be a very bad thing for a lot of people,
perfect,
right?
Perfect profession for him, yes.
And now I'm thinking we need a Sharks Leafs Cup final with some barking on the bench. You got Babcock and DeBoer, you and DJ going at it. I know you guys, you know, a little bench talk's not the worst thing in the world to stir things up, right?
And we all know how loud DJ can be. So yeah, that would be fun. But yeah, you know what? It's good to have all the boys back in town. And we have an alumni game happening the last Saturday before the final game. And we have probably about 45 guys coming back from different eras. And it's going to be a lot of fun. CHL alumni game. And, you know, even some of the old coaches are coming back. Joel Quinville is going to be on one bench. Peter DeBoer on another.
Nice.
Wayne Maxner, you know, the list goes on of old coaches at Motor City Smitty. So we got some great names coming back. We're going to have a lot of fun, a lot of catching up.
Before you go, you probably get asked a ton about Taylor and Ryan. And at 16, that was your second year coaching. They did play a ton. And you probably get asked, did you know they were that good? And at the same time, you know, my recollection is you guys gave them so many minutes early on. I want to say Taylor scored he had a 4-goal game in the fifth or sixth game of the year in Erie. And we're all like, oh, my God. Like, yeah. Right away, you know he's better than your average top two pick in the OHL, right?
Yeah, he's amazing. He scored 45 as a 16-year-old, you know, I remember my first couple practices with him, and he came up, and I was running the power play, and he wasn't on the first unit, and he pulled me aside after practice. He says, "Is there a reason I'm not on the first unit?" And that was just Taylor at the time, right? He wasn't being cocky. He was being truthful. And I said, "Listen, you're a young guy in this league. It's going to take some time. Relax, and you know, just wait your turn, and just listen during practice." Well, about two games later, after I see what he had, he was on the first unit and scored 45 goals. And Ryan Ellis, same thing. When we watched him play midget, he was just amazing. His hand eye for one, his smarts, you know, his bomb of a shot, things like that. And everybody's always worried about his size, and his skating was just average. But you know, his hockey IQ is just amazing. And he didn't take long to, I think he had 20 plus his rookie season, if I'm not mistaken. So as a defenseman, and you know, superstars in the making they were at that time. And but you know, people always ask me the question about Taylor, and because he got traded for Edmonton and Ryan and things like that. And I said, there's two guys as smart as they are and as good as they were, to compete in both of these guys was amazing. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it's something you can't teach. They had jam, they had compete, and they, you know, they do anything to win. And that's, you know, that's why we did win, because we had guys like that.
Two Memorial Cup titles. Bob Boudner joins us. They play the St. John Sea Dogs on Friday night. Really proud of you guys. Good luck in the tournament, and we know you're representing the whole province, so that's a good feeling. It's great to talk to you.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, and it was good talking to you again.
Thanks. All right. Enjoy.
All right.
So there's Bob Boudner. He's the president, the owner. I think it's 50%. He doesn't show me the books, but last time I heard, it was half the team. And was their head coach for two Memorial Cups. So great stories about Mary Lemieux and Jaromir Jagr. But there's the talk of Taylor Hall, who's been in the league seven seasons now, hasn't been able to get to the playoffs, and had to watch probably – that probably hurt him the most in a way to watch Edmonton and Carolyn do as well as they did. And now he's watching his good friend Ryan Ellis in Nashville a few games away at the most from the Stanley Cup Final, who's played 35 playoff games. You got to get lucky. Like, I think it's Jay Bouwmeester went over a decade before he got to play his first playoff game. So you need to get some bounces with who you play with.
I was thinking, too, just talking about San Jose, doesn't it feel like ages ago that they were bounced from the playoffs? That's the thing with the NHL playoffs. They take so long. Even though the first round was great and everybody loved it. I mean, a month goes by, a month and a half.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Everybody loves their favorite sport. But if you like the sports equally, what I found talking with people this week is, in the NBA, you kind of gradually build up. It's a little like the NCAA tournament, where it's not even like that, because you might get the suddenness of an upset on that first Thursday or Friday, where you're all invested because you're playing a bracket. A 13 seed beats a 4, so you have some kind of reaction to it. But even that first round, like if we take the Toronto-Milwaukee games away, there just wasn't that much that was memorable. Like, LeBron almost lost his first game. They were trailing by 20 against Indiana.
But there was still no worry. Yeah.
No, that's all you seem to remember. And yet, all we think about is, okay, when does – we got Boston, Cleveland now, and Golden State, San Antonio with all the drama there. When's the final? It doesn't matter how many games, just what day does the final start? Where will I be? Where will I watch it? How late can I stay up? All that stuff. And yet we don't have that in the NHL. Like, I'm sure – you can get a good final. Last year's final was fine in Pittsburgh-San Jose. The Sharks were a goal away from forcing a Game 7 after being down 3-1. And I do think I think Canada was conflicted. They love Sidney Crosby as a rule, but they would have liked to see Joe Thornton get his Stanley Cup ring at the age of 39. They would have loved to have seen that.
Well, and that's the thing. With the NBA, there's the climax at the end, right? And that is the main event. Where I worry this year in the NHL playoffs, and because there were so many five Canadian teams in it, that it piqued people's interest in the first round. And now, especially for casual fans, when you're trying to build up the game, I think we've lost a lot of casual fans. I think they watch Pittsburgh and Ottawa, but I don't know if they're necessarily watching casual fans for the Senators. I think they're watching because it's Sidney Crosby and company.
And yet what works for the NHL, and Gary Bettman talks about this, the commissioner of the league, is yes, the parity works, but what it stops you from doing is sort of having a little bit having the David Goliath matchup. That's a little like what Washington Toronto felt like, and I think they need more series to feel that way, where it'd be a big upset if it happened. Like, look at Nashville beat Chicago. Chicago's done so much winning, and they swept them. And what did Chicago score? 3 goals, and we were all like, yeah, that happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Cleveland or Golden State was swept in the first round of the NBA, we'd still be feeling the shockwaves. And
what a mess that would have been.
We both would have been starting to watch the NBA at different times because of our ages, but I can tell you, I mean, you'd remember how the Lakers would go into the playoffs with Shaq and Kobe, and you knew they were going to win, and you didn't know who they'd play in the final, but there wasn't any drama. The 6 titles Jordan won with the Bulls, I can tell you there wasn't one time in those 6 years where I'm like, well, they could lose in the final. You'd have been shocked at it had it happened. So we sort of, at least we have a final where I know Golden State's a heavy favorite, and we're not even there yet, but we've had amazing drama the last 2 years with Kyrie's injury 2 years ago, with Cleveland coming back from 3-1 when it just looked like another Golden State title last year. Then they add Durant. NBA fans can't wait for this. Like, I don't know what the ratings will be like in Canada or in the U.S. I love looking up that stuff, but I don't know how you create a Stanley Cup final that brings everybody together like the NBA does. But you're right. The first round, you got 16
awesome
teams' fan bases invested for 2 whole weeks, and you don't have that in the NBA.
The thing with the NHL playoffs, too, and the NBA being so long, is that's a commitment. So if you're a big hockey or basketball fan, you're watching games every single night.
Yeah. Yeah, and different hours, because you got 7
exactly.
o'clock starts, 10 o'clock starts.
That's why I love baseball's postseason. I mean, it makes no sense in my eyes that it's the longest season. You play 162 games, then you have the shortest postseason. But it just it adds that drama. They're forcing the drama into the series because you've got the wild card game, and then it's short series to begin. And then once you get to the World Series, it gets even more entertaining.
Yeah, and you can't be average. There's Bob Boudner telling us 2 years ago they had a pretty average Sharks team at Christmas time, and the coaches, it's all their first years there, and they're probably looking around going, boy, we better be better than this. That's a market where they're always good in San Jose. They have been for a decade. Even back to Ron Wilson's days, they haven't had a bad team there
just
in a long, long time.
Not
good enough, yeah. They're that team that's sort of perennially a little like the New York Rangers have been, I suppose, the last several years. They perennially fall short to some extent. But, yeah, it matters a lot more what your regular season is in the NHL, or rather in Major League Baseball. Like, you can only have so many stumbles. The Jays are like that now. Like, they'll win some, they'll lose some. They'll have good weeks, bad weeks. But what they can have is they can't go like 5-15 in a 20-game span. It finishes them, no matter what.
Unless it's April.
Unless it's yes, and then you can afford it. So you went to Vancouver a couple years after sort of the. I feel like I don't mean this as a joke based on what happened afterwards. The fires of being in the Stanley Cup final were still kind of smoldering, but I never felt like that was a team that Canada supported. And
no.
You and I both know people in the States, and they all seem to have this same theory that, well, Canada must want the cup back so badly, and we kind of do, but it's sort of on our terms. Everybody wants their team to win it. So Ottawa's the last team left, and as we speak right now, it's an even series with the Pittsburgh Penguins. But I don't know. I can't tell if it's the players. I can't tell if it's the market. My thought 10 years ago is when they played a really good Anaheim Ducks team, Edmonton had been in the finals the year before as a real underdog, scrappy 8-seed team. And I felt like people got behind them, and they're like, yeah, that'd be fun if Edmonton won, or Calgary a couple years earlier. And I didn't feel that with Ottawa, and maybe they need to get there, and maybe they need to play Anaheim, and we'd all go, yeah, we're all kind of pulling for Ottawa, because God knows they've got enough good stories,
well, that's,
right?
That's what I was thinking, with Erik Karlsson playing and skating on a broken foot, and you've got Clark MacArthur back. Jean-Gabriel Pageau has been outstanding. Yeah, there's so many stories, but I'm with you. I don't feel like, my friends who are watching the playoffs, it doesn't seem like Leafs fans and Habs fans and Canucks fans are behind them. And I don't know why. I think you need the star.
Yeah.
I think you need the star to get behind them. If the Oilers were still in it, I think that would arguably maybe be Canada's team. Justin Trudeau, though, says Ottawa's Canada's team. So
well, he
it must be
he
true.
No, and he's got the support of the people right now. That always changes. But we had a guy call our show late last week, and he said, I don't want any Canadian team to win. And I put it to him. I said, what if the final was Boston and Winnipeg? He's a diehard Leafs fan. He says, Boston, Winnipeg, I cheer for Boston. I'm like,
that doesn't make sense, though, even as a Leafs.
It makes no sense.
See,
yeah.
I can't deal with those types of arguments.
Why would you want your division rival, Boston, a Detroit again to win, or even a Tampa Bay? Why would you want that team instead of, I know, I think part of it is, and I'd say this, it's been 24 years since Montreal won in 93, and maybe there is a bit of a Holy Grail scenario. It is a bit of a Ark of the Covenant. Everybody wants to be the first. If it was happening all the time, like it did in the 70s and 80s with Montreal, Edmonton, Calgary, maybe it wouldn't feel as special. But we know what a explosion it'll be emotionally one way or the other for a Canadian team to win again. It just will be.
People just don't like to be told how to feel either. And I don't think people like to be told this is now Canada's team if you're a fan of one of the other Canadian teams.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about it. It's
I think,
don't tell me who to cheer for. I'll figure it out on my own.
I think that's true. But it's the one league where you've got 7 out of 30 teams. So there is choice and there is options. Like maybe in the States, and it's like, I don't think allegiances switch in the NFL. Your team goes out, you might have a rooting interest, or you want to root against, you don't like the Cowboys or you don't like the Patriots, you kind of go there. But there isn't this adamant, well, if the Buffalo Bills go out, well, anybody but all the other AFC East teams, I hate all those. I don't feel like there's that animosity that we Canadians have, like you said. Like, and Sens fans, I do feel like, have that, there's a little bit of a little brother thing with Toronto on the one side and Montreal on the other. Like,
yeah,
they're stuck in the middle. They want more attention. They always complain if their games aren't on Saturday nights on the CBC. They're like, oh, now you're making a big fuss about it. We're like, yes, you're the only team left. You have good stories. You're likable. We want to root for you. They're more likable than that Vancouver team. I'd say that. Than 6 years, you know, with Roberto Luongo on last week and the Sedins, but they had a lot of polarizing players with your Burrows and your Kessler and Maxim Lapierre, Kevin Bieksa, a lot of guys that people went back and forth on.
Yeah, I think in Canada too, we're naive to think that just because you're in Toronto, obviously you're a Leafs fan, and just because you're in Lower Mainland out west, you're a Canucks fan. I think what happens in the playoffs a lot of the time and during the regular season is you have people rooting for their hometown guys. And I think that's how they pick their teams in the playoffs. So they're not just cheering for Ottawa because they live in the area. They might be cheering for another team because their buddy's friend plays for that team.
So something coming up, something that happened in Vancouver on the weekend was the start of U2's Joshua Tree Tour.
Yeah, Deja Vu.
Yeah, it's been 30 years since that album, about that spring, since it got put out. And we're going to talk in a little bit to Mike Edgar, who's an Irish DJ, Irish journalist, who knows the band really well, knows the four guys. It is a real rarity for a band. I mean, a lot of bands stick around a long time, but they'll play like a summer amphitheater to 9,000 people, and they won't have put out new albums recently, and people just want to come and see the old hits.
Mm-hmm.
U2's been, I'm trying to think of the parallel, because the Beatles lasted 7 years and 8 years, and there's not too many acts that you don't look at and go, they're still doing new things, they're still exciting people, and yet people love their past. Like, people older than us love to go see the Rolling Stones, or they love to go see The Who, but there really isn't anything that's come out new that has got people in the last 30 years or so, right?
Well, and this is interesting, too, coming from U2, because U2's always been that band that's pushing forward and coming out with new things. So it's interesting for them to be touring an old album.
Yeah. And there hasn't been not even, I mentioned those Rolling Stones, The Who bands. There are usually, you don't bust up for a little while, but you take a long break. Somebody does a solo album, they go out on their own, like Mick Jagger can do a solo album or Pete Townsend can do a solo album. This is the one band that, like, I grew up loving REM, and at some point REM just said, we're out of ideas. We loved it. This was great. The audiences were great. We don't want to do this. And they've stuck to it. I think they've been sort of busted up and retired, because you don't usually retire in music. You just you go away, or you're playing to 500 people or 5,000 people and
Casino-rama.
Yes, and that's okay. That's people are coming in with oxygen tanks and casino chips, and they want to see you. But this must have been, I don't know anybody in Vancouver that went to the show, but it's coming here.
Oh yeah, and I saw on social media it looked like a scene.
Yeah,
and it all generations. musicians. That's what's cool, too.
Yeah, and they put, younger people can appreciate an album that's 30 years old. So coming up in just a little bit, we're going to talk to Mike Edgar about that.
Point Taken with Greg Brady and Carolyn Cameron.
We're very pleased to welcome Mike Edgar to the show. Mike's a longtime disc jockey, a presenter, an executive as well, in a big-time Irish radio person, let's put it that way, basically for the spanning of U2's career. If anything, maybe his career has been more consistent, though I'm sure he's taken as many chances as U2 has. U2 playing in Vancouver just this past Friday, opening up the Joshua Tree 30th Anniversary Tour. They'll be in Toronto later on this spring and, of course, headed back overseas for a lot of European shows. Luckily enough, featuring Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds as an opener. So I'm jealous already, seeing them in Toronto last year. Mike, it's great of you to do this across the Atlantic. We really do appreciate it.
Greg, I'm loving it. And thank you very much to you and Carolyn for having me on.
We're happy to. Tell us a little bit about the early days with U2. I mean, I would have discovered them at maybe age 11 with War coming out. And maybe Sunday Bloody Sunday was the first song I heard on the radio. You must dip back to their first two albums and a little bit before that, obviously.
Yeah, I guess so, Greg. Yeah, I mean, I kind of remember them from, well, definitely back to Boy and October and War, you know, that whole period of about 1980 to 1983 and around there. And I also had a friend back in down in Dublin who saw them back in the late 70s, probably in around 79, and they won a band competition for 500 quids worth of studio time. And off the back of that studio time, they got a deal with CBS, and then basically from CBS on to Island Records in around 1980. So I kind of became aware of them because, you know, Ireland's a small place. You know, at that stage, we were only a nation of 3.5 million people. Most of the bands knew each other, but there was still, a divide between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, and back in those days there wasn't a lot of mixing up. You know, the Dublin bands were the Dublin bands in Republic of Ireland, and you know, the Belfast bands were the Belfast bands in Northern Ireland. So there was this professional sort of jealousy between bands, which kind of goes on. I'm sure it's the same in parts of Canada and the rest of it. But we all grew out of that, thank God. But yeah, I kind of remember them, and I certainly remember them doing some of their first shows for the BBC back in the day. They did the Boy Tour and appeared in Belfast in the McMurtry Hall at Queen's University in 1981, and we filmed that. And it was just a seminal moment. You know, they were doing 11 o'clock TikTok and I Will Follow and Out of Control, these tracks that just became absolute, you know, blinders. And back then it was kind of weird because they looked like a fantastic bunch of kind of guys with kind of new romantic hair. But they, you know, they were coming off the tail end of punk rock, and it was difficult for them, to be honest, guys, because they lived in Dublin, and I remember interviewing Bono on several occasions when, you know, we were chatting, and he said, look, you know, we came from the world of, you know, Irish show bands, the show bands, cabaret bands, you know, were king in Ireland in the 70s and into the early 80s. Meanwhile, in Belfast, across the border, punk rock was huge, you know, and you had bands like the Stiff Little Fingers and the Undertones and the Outcasts and Kids Screaming SSRUC and all this kind of stuff. So I think they were sort of jealously, Bono would say himself, they were jealously looking at the north of Ireland, thinking, we'd love to be part of that scene, because when they were 14, 15, 16, you know, they were covering the Sex Pistols and, you know, they were covering the sort of the punk bands of the day. And it sort of took them a wee bit of time to find their form. But, you know, when they got in the traps, boy, did they come out of the traps. And, you know, that 1981 Boy Tour was kind of like the beginning of it. But yeah, I kind of know of them all the way back to Mount Temple School, 1976, when Larry Mullen decided that he was going to put the band together. And I think, you know, they were originally called The Feedback or The Hype or something of that nature. And they very self-aware kind of guys and very lovely guys that they are, you know, will admit, you know, they weren't very good back in those days. But like any band, you got to earn your stripes and you got to get on the road and learn your craft, you know?
I mean, now they've transcended music. But back when you first met Bono and the band, were their personalities similar to what they are now, or have they changed quite a bit?
Do you know what, Carla? I don't actually think they've changed that much. Any time I've ever met them, and, you know, obviously it started out kind of more on a professional basis back in, in the mid-80s or whatever, they are really, really decent, four decent guys. Very intelligent, very thoughtful. But obviously, you know, things changed because, you know, they went from being kind of small and punk rock and, you know, playing places like the National Stadium in Dublin, which was a huge gig for them, to maybe 1,500, 2,000 people. And then next thing they're there at Red Rocks, and then Live Aid happens in about 85, 86, and then they're completely out of the traps and heading down that road to arena status. And you know, the world changed on Sixpence with Live Aid, I think, with U2, and indeed with this album that they're celebrating right now. You know, it was incredible. But no, I think fundamentally they're the same people. I think at times, unfairly, people think, you know, that they're a band for a cause and the rest of it. But actually, I think they're just four people that care about the world and are not afraid to talk about it and not afraid to do their bit. And I have to say, on many occasions, they have done their bit for Northern Ireland during the dark days and tried really, really hard to make a difference in a really, really good way for this part of the world, and did their bit to try and help push people towards peace and understanding, and particularly around the time of the Good Friday Agreement. So I actually can't say anything bad about them. I kind of feel that they are true to themselves and still want to be musicians, still want to be contenders, still want, you know, they constantly reinvent themselves every tour they go out on. You know, they're not a cabaret band. They're not in that kind of, you know, been around a long time, just out doing the hits. You know, every time they bring out an album, they still want to be contenders. They're still happy to go on kids' TV shows because they want a new generation of fans, as well as the guys that are as old and crusty as myself, you know.
So is that why they're doing this tour now? Because some critics online, they're saying maybe it's a bit of a cash grab because it's not new music, it's old music. But then if you look at what's happening right now in the States and the kinds of songs and messages that are on the Joshua Tree, it seems quite timely, especially for a new, different generation of fans.
Look, you've hit it on the head because, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, when we first saw that album 30 years ago, it was just such a great record. I think, you know, they've earned the right to go out and celebrate it. Yeah, it'll make a few quid, let's be honest. You know, everybody wants to make a few pounds. They're not short of a few ball, Carolyn, anyway. At the same time, I'm sure this will pay for a couple more cars or whatever, but I don't think they're driven by that anymore. I think they kind of knew that they had to do something. They also are a band, let's be honest, you know, they've been around since, in, you know, some form or another, since 1976, so it's nearly 40 years, and they're probably in their own heads thinking, how do we celebrate the fact that we've been doing this for a long time? And they maybe don't want to say, right, we've been around that long or whatever, but, you know, it would be nice to doff our caps and do something around the album that really, you know, sort of like took us to another level. And I think no finer way of doing it than celebrating 30 years of the Joshua Tree, you know, which was just so, so good. And I remember the first time, you know, I saw them do it, you know, here in Belfast. It was just a total moment, you know.
Mike Edgar is kind enough to join us on the Point Taken podcast on Sportsnet. Of course, from joining us today from Belfast, Northern Ireland, and it's incredible, 30 years since the Joshua Tree. You hit on the two moments. One for me would be Live Aid in 85. The other would be Pride in the Name of Love is their first American top 40 single. So when the Joshua Tree hits out, and With or Without You is the first single, are you thinking, this is their window. They can book stadiums, but, Mike, it's a small window. Like, the Police had this with Synchronicity, and they said it's not going to get any bigger. Sting goes on his own. I love Simple Minds. They had a run of one big arena rock album, and then that's it. Did you go and, well, of course, this will be their moment, but the moments don't always last for rock bands like U2's have.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes them different, Greg. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they are, you know, they're a band. I mean, they went on to do Acton Baby, which is just a fantastic album. You know, the Zoo TV tour was arguably one of the best and most complex technical tours of its time. Pop Mart was, a complete fantastic Spinal Tap craziness. You know, and then they go off and do things like How to Dismantle Atomic Bomb and everything. They just kept doing new stuff, and they always want to work with new people. And if you look at the things they've done over the years, they haven't been scared to, you know, jump in with country music, jump in with great DJs and guys like David Holmes, you know, doff their cap to the kings of rhythm and blues like B.B. King, mix it up with people like Holly B, all that kind of stuff. They're always going, what's happening now? out. How can we be part of that? How can we reinvent ourselves? We don't want to become crusty. We want to actually still be relevant. And I think every album has been different. Arguably, you know, a lot of people will say that was the record, but they just carried on and carried on and made some fantastic work after that to this very, very day. But clearly, you're quite right at that period of the mid-80s. I mean, actually, Simple Minds is a really good comparison, something that you brought up just there. Because Simple Minds and you, I mean, arguably people might say at one stage in the UK, Simple Minds were, you know, almost bigger, you know.
And, that's right.
And they were doing, they had Waterfront and City of Light and all that stuff that was happening back then. But U2 have stayed the course of time. And I think that's because they've been true to themselves. They've worked hard. They've, you know, buddied up with different people. They've spread the love around, but sometimes come back to the same producers, people that they trust and know. And there's like that U2 family of people that they take advice from, people like, you know, well, Lily White, and people like Gavin Friday, people who are good touchstones to them. So they don't kind of lose the way of themselves, but they're always, always wanting to do something different, you know.
Do you think they'll ever finish making new music, or do you think they have many more albums left in them?
Oh, kind of. I think they will. I don't think they will. You know, I think they'll just keep going. And it's funny, you know, when you look around. I mean, a minute ago we talked about Simple Minds, but you could say the same of REM. You could say the same of, you know, so many other bands that were kind of huge during that period. And they're the only ones that they're like the great survivors.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of hope that they will just keep doing new music, and I kind of think it's in them. I think sometimes they need to go away for a couple of years and you know, have a think about things, have a rest, and then come back and do it again. But I mean, they have really, you know, they have worked their socks off from the very, very early days. You know, when, I don't know, you know, back to the days when there were, you know, people like Bill Graham at Hot Press were toting them around and trying to introduce them to people, the great people like Paul McGuinness. And they have just worked and worked and worked. They know it's a business, but at the same time, you know, they're just, you know, into their songwriting, they're into their sounds, they're into learning stuff. And they're also quite humble, you know. I mean, I remember, you know, they take so much from other people, you know. I remember talking to Larry about drumming and him saying, you know, one of his heroes was Billy Docherty from Derry band The Undertones. First time he ever heard Teenage Kicks by The Undertones, and he just couldn't wait to meet those kind of guys. So I think they've still got a spark in them. They're not just doing it for the money. They do it because that's what they do, and that's what drives them.
Mm. It's Mike Edgar joining us from Belfast. U2 is in Toronto on June the 23rd to play Rogers Centre. They just did Vancouver, just did Seattle. They're in Santa Clara at the 49ers, great new stadium tonight, and then over to Europe for the summer. So give me, now we're being really kind to them, give me a misstep. Every actor, Tom Hanks has a movie, and he's like, oh, I can't believe I made that. There must have been, like, I'll give you a couple. One, they might have put Rattle and Hum out too quickly after the Joshua Tree. Maybe people needed a break. Maybe they needed to break themselves, and you mentioned a couple of the albums. Pop seemed too much for people. Like, there are always times, and like we said with some of the other bands, there's that dip and you're like, I don't know if they're back from this. And then you hear Beautiful Day on the radio, they did the Super Bowl that year, and you're like, of course. Like, they've had a few weird comebacks that put them right back to the top, because you can't stay on the top for 30 years. Nobody can.
No, I mean, and let's be honest, they've had some lukewarm albums. They've done some things that possibly, you know, maybe could have done with a bit more thinking, like, you know, the whole scene around, you know, putting the album through Apple onto your iPod and all that kind of thing, whether you wanted it or didn't want it. You know, that sort of carry on. I think a lot of music lovers, at a principle, goes, I didn't want that on my iPod, get that off, don't care how good it is or not, you know. So, you know, they have had a few moments where maybe at times, you know, the decisions could have been a bit better and that kind of carry on. And I know there are a lot of people, are you weirdy, Karen Craig? You know, Pop Mart was one of those ones that a lot of people kind of go, oh, bad move, what the hell is going on? And they're appearing in a spinning yellow lemon at the front of the stage. You know, I was almost waiting for Stonehenge to come out.
That's right.
Yeah, kind of carry on. But actually, strangely, one of my favorite tours, I know a lot of people slag it off, but, you know, Mofo, all that kind of stuff, there's just some great stuff on that. But listen, there is no doubt whatsoever. You know, they'd be the first to admit they don't know everything. They don't make all the right moves. At times, they've spoken up at times when it's probably best not to have spoken up. They've released some things that are, you know, sometimes a little bit dubious that I know they would be unhappy with. Sometimes they've had to rush records out when they probably wouldn't have wanted to rush records out. But in the main, you know, over a career that spanned nearly 40 years, it's not a bad strike rate. You know, their success story. I mean, you know, if you're an 18-year-old kid and you love your music and you're sitting in Toronto and you're thinking, what am I going to do? You know, this is one of the bands to capture while you can capture. You know, they are a supergroup, a true supergroup that you should need to go and see with true musicianship. They're not miming. They're up there. They're giving it loads. And, you know, you cannot help but be moved when some of those songs come on. That rumble of Still Haven't Found and The Streets of No Name comes, you know, radiating through the floor of the arena as you're sitting there. Can't fail to put the hairs on the back of your neck up. So they're just kind of one of those, you know, it's a bit like Pink Floyd. If you got the chance to go and see them, why wouldn't you go and see them? You know, they're just one of those bands. But, yeah, you're right, Greg. They've had a few dodgy moments over the years, and they've been lampooned by many over the years as well. But they have a big place in my heart, I can tell you, you know, and particularly because their interest you know, helping the Northern Ireland peace process back in the day. They were just incredible.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for coming on. Enjoy the tour when it comes home to you. I think Greg's searching for tickets right now, actually, on his computer.
I'd love to be there. Well, I'd love to see them in Dublin. I would be lucky enough to see them. That's an expensive expensive undertaking. Hey, it was awesome having you on, Mike. We'll have to do this again. We'll try, and maybe we'll even do it when Colin is over here in later in the summer. So that is Mike Edgar. As mentioned, the show in Toronto on June 23rd at Rogers Centre. Tickets are unavailable for that show. They are very, very unavailable. And I need an angle. So... we'll find a way, because I'm going to try and go. I would assume you are also, and you have no
What's
tickets.
The date?
June 23rd. No, it's okay. June 23rd is the date. I think it's a Friday night or Saturday night, so that makes it even harder than a Monday. That's
Oh, see, I like that.
Someone must have tickets that just wants to see the Lumineers open, because I don't care about that. You can watch the Lumineers 10 songs, then come outside the venue, give me the tickets, and I'll find a way to explain my way in.
I would love to see both.
Would you?
Yeah.
Well, that's we differ. We differ there. I always hear that one movie in that Bradley Cooper, what's the Silver Lining Playbook?
Oh yeah, great movie.
I know, but I always hear that song, and I'm like, there I am. I'm watching the movie, and it was a good movie, no question. So that's as much as you could possibly hear about you two. Next week on Point Taken, we know we'll be talking to Josie Altidore, the striker from Toronto FC, who's off to a great start. They're off to a great start, just one defeat in the first 12 games.
Yeah.
And as title starved as we are, and as unfortunate as the nil-nil draw and the penalty kick shootout was against Seattle Sounders last December, that was like about 2 weeks before Christmas. We're hoping this year may bring a Toronto FC title, but they're well atop the Eastern Conference right now. So Josie Altidore will join us for a long-form chat next week on the show.
I'm excited. Okay, I'm also excited for my favorite segment. We still haven't decided on a name. What was your name?
I can't remember.
Oh, my name wins. What up with that?
It's sticking for right now.
Oh, okay,
and it's finding a way. Yeah, it's finding a way into the context of the show. So this is where sort of clean up the week. There's some stories you noticed, I noticed.
Yeah, and we just sometimes some things are bugging us, so we just bring it up. Okay, here's a story that caught my eye. Millionaire to Millennials is the headline. Stop buying avocado toast if you want to buy a home. So it's an Australian millionaire property mogul, Tim Gurner. And he's saying, quote, when I was trying to buy my first home, I wasn't buying smashed avocado for $19 and four coffees at $4 each. I mean, he gets into the math, but he's basically saying avocado prices are going up and you need to stop buying avocado toast.
So what's now, do you actually know what that is? Have you had?
Oh, yeah, I had
you
it
know
for
what
breakfast
avocado
this morning.
Toast is.
Well, it's just toast.
I just buy Wonder Bread every week at Sobeys. They should sponsor
no,
us.
No, it's toast. So it's just you putting avocado on top of your Wonder Bread.
Oh, you can't actually buy avocado. Okay. No one calls anything peanut butter toast when they buy toast and put peanut butter on it.
That's true.
It's an
That's
energy
actually
thing.
A good point.
What's well, you're single. You're a millennial. You're not, but you do not. Are you saving to buy? Would you like to reveal some financial information? Are you? Do you say I got to stop spending money on this to? Because I remember when we wanted to buy our first home, my wife and I, we really cut a lot. We're like, we're going out for dinner once a month, like that kind of. Do you have ideas for that kind of stuff? Toronto's not cheap.
No, I am saving money, but I have never thought, you know what, I should stop buying avocados.
What's the one thing you want to spend less on of your disposable income? Because you're not, I'm going out on a limb also, you're not a massive partier, but you will go out.
I feel like I spend a lot going out.
But you work evenings. It's really, really hard to see people.
No, but I mean, yeah, but on weekends or even meeting people for dinner before work. I do spend money.
You don't go to just like Subway or Harvey's for dinner?
No. Sorry.
What's an expensive?
But I do buy avocado. Oh, I don't go out for expensive dinners.
Yeah.
It's like $25.
We were debating on the morning show what steak you stop buying a steak at.
Oh, I'm not a big steak fan. I've never.
Like, okay, let's say a salmon dish. Like, I feel like once you're in an entree, and some people will be very snooty about this. I think once you're past $50. And I could see, I'm sure I bought like a $60 or $70 steak. Never $100. And the same thing with wine.
I
can't tell the difference. So it doesn't matter to me. I won't. We're not going to sit there and have a special occasion.
We sound
occasion
very cultured.
And who does? No, we don't. It's,
I'm being sarcastic.
Yes. The keg is it.
The point is,
if it gets francier than the keg, I'm not doing it.
The point is, I will continue to buy avocados, and there's nothing anyone can do about it.
What about your coffees?
Yeah.
Homebrew it.
Yeah.
With a Keurig.
I do like getting a latte, though.
Okay.
Okay, next story. LSU coach, he really likes his energy drinks. I think it's Ed Orgeron. We don't know exactly how to pronounce his name.
If it's not Nick Saban,
really,
I don't know.
We really did our
in
research.
The SEC.
So he was interviewed, and he said on a typical day, he drinks 8 to 10 energy drinks, which would kill me. I've never had a full Red Bull, ever. I've had a sip or two. I'm scared of them.
This won't be good advertising. Again, if we're looking for sponsors, Red Bull pull out. I had a trainer once, and he wasn't even my trainer, or she wasn't even my trainer, and she said, there's more. She just said the word carcinogens, because I used to drink it before, like maybe a hockey game or something. And she said, there's more carcinogens in one can of Red Bull than in an entire pack of cigarettes. And I've never had one since. And I was never a mix it with vodka, like a bar drink type guy. I'll have beer, I'll have wine, I might have a Caesar. That's it. That's my limitation. I'm not a hard liquor guy. Gatorade, vitamin water?
Oh, yeah, but I don't drink, because I don't do too well with caffeine.
Despite your lattes.
I get decaf or half caf.
I don't know what would be too much to stop a human being. Like, if I had a friend and I'd say, you know what, that's your fifth Red Bull today.
Take it easy.
Like, we would do it with alcohol, but where would we stop it with energy drinks and tons of milligrams of caffeine? I don't know.
I wonder what the most, how many Brett Laurie's had, the most he's ever had in one day. I feel like he might hold the record.
And why? Yeah, he played up that image quite a bit. But now he just eats sunflower seeds, I think. Remember he had a sunflower seed sponsorship deal?
Oh, yeah. I mean, those are delicious.
They're reasonably good. Yeah. So I feel like four. Four is the limit where I'd say to somebody, you got a problem and we need to get you on like something called ice water.
I'm going
to
say end it at one or none. Yeah. Okay. Roger Federer, arguably the greatest tennis player of all time.
Well, he's arguably. He's not undeniably. I'm glad. Thank you. You're giving me some wiggle room here.
Well, no, I'm just being factually correct after not being able to pronounce a name in the past story.
Yeah.
So Federer is skipping the French Open, which is not a surprise because he's 35 and he's resting, and rest did him well. Last season, he took the second half of the season off. That was due to injury, but then he came back and won the Australian Open. He won Miami. He won Indian Wells. Are you disappointed, though, he won't be playing in the French Open?
Well, I think it's too bad. I understand. I'm going to say at 35, Roger should be about Roger, and if he wants to win Wimbledon one more time, you'd concur, right? Going to the French isn't the best way to do it. You need to play the grass court tournaments, and he's only won the French the one time, right?
Yeah, so 2009.
Yeah, so it's probably smart. I'm disappointed if you bought tickets for the French Open and hoped he was there. But tennis is tricky, right? He had that big tournament at the O2 in London the one year he was supposed to play Djokovic. And I think he called it like 3 hours before that morning on the Sunday. He was like, I'm not going to play it. And he had Davis Cup the next week and was perfectly healthy. So it's a tricky. Tennis suffers this. Tennis has this happen all the time with pullouts. Like Rogers Cup dealt with this with women's. The women's tour for a long, long time, right? Where it was killing Carl Hale. Like, you'd have like five of the top eight seeds pull out, and it's hard, but.
It's not a surprise. I get it. As mentioned, he's 35 years old. I would rather have him healthy for Wimbledon when he has a really good chance than wear himself out, get out early in the French, and then not even make it far at Wimbledon. And Rafa is the clear favorite. He's won, I think, 15 straight matches right now on clay, 3 titles. He's the favorite.
But you probably predict, if you could predict, you'd probably predict a Nadal Djokovic final.
Oh,
at the French.
I don't even know. Maybe Murray. Djokovic has been a mess this season.
I know. And Milos Raonic, you would say, what's a good, like semifinals on clay would be a great
result.
That
would be
for
great.
Him.
Yeah, it's tough, though. For he and Jeannie, Clay is not their best friend.
Well, we kept our tennis to a minimum, and we did it at the end. If people thought too much tennis in week one, there's nothing we can do about it. It may come up week after, because we're heading into a big season with the French and Wimbledon.
We will have to do something ahead of the French and or Wimbledon, though.
Yeah.
Have a tennis guest on.
So our thanks to Bob Bugner. Our thanks to Mike Edgar. Mm-hmm. This was a fun show. Josie Altidore will be on next week's show. And until then, you may follow us on Twitter at SN.Taken. We'll both be healthier next week.
We hope.
Your elbow, my knee, various body parts will be in better condition for episode 3. Have a great week, and we'll be back next week.
See ya.
You've been listening to Point Taken with Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady on Sportsnet.ca/590.